lick his wounds until election night, when he would resurface and take the stage to accept a surprisingly narrow victory. Gwendy had events planned for every day leading up to the election, sometimes two or three in the same 12-hour block, but even taken as a whole, she knew it wasn't enough to move the needle 3 percentage points. They were simply running out of time. Gwendy believed there was only one surefire way to guarantee a miracle, and it was sitting on a shelf inside her garage at home in Castle Rock. Over the course of the next 2 weeks, usually while tossing and turning in one hotel bed or another, after a while they all looked and smelled the same, there were at least half a dozen instances where she convinced herself that pulling out the button box was the right thing to do. Presto! Push the red button and make Paul McGowan disappear like a rabbit in a magician's hat. But each time, her conscience and Richard Ferris's words of warning stopped her. You must resist. Don't touch the button box or even take it out of the canvas bag unless absolutely necessary. Every time you do, it will get more of a hold on you. And then, on the Thursday night before Election Day, Gwendy got her miracle. Like most of his longtime GOP counterparts, Paul McGowan's bread-and-butter constituency was made up of pro-life, pro-religion, pro-build-the-wall, loud-and-proud NRA members. As a proclaimed Christian and father of five, he spoke often and passionately of his abhorrence of the ungodly and downright evil practice of abortion. He called the doctors that performed such procedures soulless butchers and devils in blood-smeared white coats. On that Thursday evening, word leaked to the national press that a front-page article in the next morning's edition of the Portland Press-Herald would be outlining in great detail and providing written documentation that proved Paul McGowan had not only had a year-long dalliance with a young woman from his local church, but that he'd also paid, using illegal campaign funds no less, for her to abort their unborn child. McGowan's campaign immediately scheduled a late-night news conference to try to get ahead of the story, but it was too late. The ball had already dropped right on top of McGowan's arrogant and hypocritical bald head and started rolling downhill. Fast. When the final votes were tallied a few days later, New York Times best-selling author Gwendy Peterson became senator-elect of the great state of Maine. She won by a margin of 4 points, which meant that thousands of full-time residents had still punched their ticket for Paul McGowan. Life in America, Gwendy thought when she contemplated all those McGowan votes. Life in pandemic America. Chapter 20. Gwendy swipes to the control screen on her iPad, taps video link, and a blank picture-in-picture display opens in the upper right-hand corner. She hits the reverse image icon, and the top of her head appears in the small window. Adjusting the angle, she gives one final tap, and her smiling face fills the entire screen. Got it, she says with no small measure of pride. Gwendy's long gray hair is pulled back into a neat ponytail, and there are circles of bright color in her cheeks. Her blue eyes are clear and alert. She looks much younger than her 64 years and feels it, too. There you are, Kathy Lundgren floats down into view. Ready for your close-up, Mrs. Peterson? Gwendy extends her hand. Of course I am, darling, she says in a haughty tone. Kathy laughs and feigns kissing the senator's hand. Kathy was worried about Gwendy earlier, when she first told her the news about the fire. The senator had appeared lost, almost in a daze. But now that she's down here face to face, she finds that she can't stop staring at her. My goodness, a couple hours of rest did wonders for you. You look and sound terrific. That and a strategic touch or two of makeup. Only Gwendy didn't bring much on this trip. Why would she? She's about as low maintenance as they come. Well, whatever it is, send some my way, why don't you? Adesh Patel glides past Kathy on his way to his flight chair. She gives him a friendly nod and looks back at Gwendy. A little less than 5 minutes till go. Gwendy adjusts the straps on her flight seat and wiggles her hips until she's comfortable. She glances up at the overhead monitors and then down at her iPad. Licking her lips, she tastes a hint of chocolate on the back of her tongue. She instantly feels the thump, thump, thump of her heart beginning to race beneath her jumpsuit. The tiny piece of chocolate had been in the shape of an ostrich. When she'd pulled open the drawstring of the canvas bag and slid out the button box, she'd been amazed at how heavy it felt in her hands, despite their weightless environment. Much heavier than she remembered, and somehow significantly heavier than when she was carrying it around inside the reinforced steel case. She knew that made little sense, no sense at all, in fact, but didn't spend much time thinking about it. All things were possible when it came to the button box. Her decision had already been made by the time she'd punched in the 7-digit code and opened the small white case marked classified material, so there was little hesitation once the moment came. She lifted the box onto her lap, reached down and pulled the lever on the left side, the one closest to the red button. And then she'd thought, if you're monitoring this, Ferris, you can kiss my bony white ass. The narrow wooden shelf slid soundlessly open from the center of the box. She picked up the chocolate ostrich and popped it into her mouth, barely taking the time to appreciate its fine detail. Closing her eyes, she allowed it to melt on her tongue, savoring the familiar burst of exotic flavor. Once the chocolate was gone, she immediately thought about pulling the lever a second time, but fought back the temptation. She knew she was already pressing her luck. After leaving the control room earlier and assuring a concerned Bern Stapleton that she was okay and just needed to rest, Gwendy retired to her cabin. When she stretched out atop the cramped bunk and buckled herself in, she hadn't even been thinking about the button box and its magic treats. All she wanted was to close her eyes and make the world go away for a short time. She was physically and mentally exhausted, and she was scared. Despite what Kathy Lundgren and Bern Stapleton believed, it wasn't the fire in Castle Rock that had Gwendy so distraught, although that certainly didn't help matters. It was a combination of everything. The video conference worried her greatly. One untimely misstep and she knew she was finished. Her heart ached fiercely. Despite the friendships she'd made, she hadn't realized how alone she'd feel on this trip. It had been almost 7 years now, but not having Ryan waiting for her back at home left Gwendy feeling forlorn and adrift. And then there were the brain freezes. Ever since quarantine, and especially ever since they'd boarded Eagle 19 Heavy, they were coming with an increasing frequency that terrified her. Initially, she'd believed it was stress worsening her symptoms, but in her heart, she knew that wasn't the case. The button box had somehow discovered her plan and was trying to stop her before they reached MF1. Reaching down and touching the notebook tucked safely inside the pocket of her jumpsuit, she thought, how long until the only things I remember are the words inside this notebook? And what about when I no longer remember how to read? Just the thought of that happening made Gwendy want to pull her hair out or scream or do both. Lying there, head spinning, staring up at the curved ceiling of her cabin, she'd eventually dozed and dreamed. Gareth Winston sits cross-legged on the floor beneath his porthole. No other crew members are in sight, and the ship is eerily silent. Winston is naked, except for a saggy pair of soiled tighty-whities. His man boobs and bright pink nipples are ringed by unruly snatches of curly dark hair. The button box rests atop his pale, chubby legs, and at first glance, it appears to be smeared in blood. But then Gwendy sees that Winston's sausage-like fingers are dripping with globs of melting chocolate. So are his mouth and all three of his chins. It's everywhere. He reaches down and pulls the lever on the right side of the box. Out slides the wooden tray with a tiny chocolate donkey centered atop it. Winston grabs the chocolate and crams it into his mouth, slurping noisily. So good, he exclaims, and lifting his arm high above his head, he points a single finger in the air and, never one to pass up on an expansive gesture, twirls his finger around and around before lowering it in agonizing slow motion until it rests directly atop the red button. He giggles, drooling a rope of chocolate saliva onto his lap, and presses the button. Once, twice. He looks up then, grinning with stained teeth, and bellows, "There! Now I'm number one in the world!" Strapped onto her bunk, Gwendy jerked awake with a scream of terror lodged in her throat and knew exactly what she needed to do. 30 seconds, Kathy Lundgren says. Gwendy steals a sidelong glance at Winston, who is buckled into his seat and facing the opposite direction. She checks her teeth in the iPad screen, all clean, no chocolate, and releases a deep, steadying breath. Here goes nothing, folks. She places her finger over the live video icon and listens to the Operation Commander countdown. 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. And you're a go. Gwendy puts a big smile on her face and taps the icon. "Greetings, Earthlings, from my home away from home, Eagle 19 Heavy. My name is Senator Gwendy Peterson from the great state of Maine, and I will be serving as your tour guide today. Before I unbuckle and give you a look at the amazing view just outside this porthole, I want to introduce you to our esteemed flight commander, Miss Kathy Lundgren. Say hi to everybody, Kathy. The three handsome gentlemen sitting to my immediate left are..." Chapter 21. In January 2020, after serving in a number of high-profile intelligence positions, including Deputy Group Chief of Counterterrorism, as well as CIA Station Chief in London, Munich, and New York, 63-year-old Charlotte Morgan became the 8th appointee and only the 2nd woman to be named as Deputy Director of the Central Intelligence Agency. She was also one of Gwendy Peterson's closest and most trusted friends. They'd first met at a budget meeting during the summer of 2003 when Gwendy was serving her 2nd term in the House of Representatives. Charlotte Morgan was temporarily living in D.C., spearheading a 6-month training program for overseas operatives. After running into each other at a number of social functions, including a handful of Orioles games, they became fast friends, bonding over their mutual affection for jogging, junk food, and violent crime novels, especially those penned by the dashing John Sandford. Charlotte returned abroad when the training program ended, but the two women stayed in touch via telephone and email and visited often during Charlotte's thrice-yearly trips home. When Charlotte got married to her 2nd husband on a private Delaware beach in 2005, Gwendy served as one of 4 bridesmaids. The following winter, when Charlotte gave birth to a healthy baby girl, on her 49th birthday, she and her husband chose Gwendy to be the child's godmother. Years later, when Gwendy's mom passed away on a cold October afternoon, Charlotte hopped on the next available flight from New York and was holding her friend's hand later that same evening. In many ways, Charlotte Morgan became the older sister Gwendy had always wished for. As Gwendy parked her car by the Lake Fairfax boat ramp in Reston, Virginia, on the morning of December 9, 2023, and spotted her old friend sitting alone on a bench near the water's edge, she prayed that their long history would be enough, or at least a start. Charlotte glanced up from the book she was reading, flipped Gwendy a wave, then lifted her hands to her shoulders in a "what's going on" gesture. Gwendy got out of the car and slowly made her way over to the bench, carrying the canvas bag in her right hand. "No security?" Charlotte asked, only half joking. "I'm driving a rental Kia. That's security enough." Not to mention the button box, Gwendy thought. "You're killing me, dear one," Charlotte said, closing the thick hardcover on her lap. "It's got to be 10 degrees out here. Spill it. Why all the secrecy?" Gwendy took a seat next to her friend, placing the canvas bag by her feet. "Have you ever considered me anything other than completely sane, reasonable, and honest?" Charlotte's smile faded. She looked closely at her friend. "Are you in some kind of trouble?" "You could say that," Gwendy agreed. "Please answer the question." "Other than your bullheaded allegiance to the Red Sox, you've proven to be one of the most sane and trustworthy people I know. Top 2 or 3, for sure." "You know that." "Then I need you to listen to me very carefully. Can you do that?" Charlotte didn't answer right away, She was still too stunned by the turn the meeting had taken. She'd come expecting Gwendy to tell her that she was finally dating someone after the last 4 years of living like a nun, but this sounded much more serious. She didn't care for the drawn look on Gwendy's face. "I can do that."
"Be sure, because I'm going to tell you something that will be very difficult to believe. Then I'm going to show you what's inside this bag and give you a demonstration of how it works."
Charlotte leaned forward and gave the drawstring bag a closer look. She opened her mouth to respond, but Gwendy cut her off again.
"If you start to interrupt, I'm going to walk back to my car and drive away and pretend this meeting never happened."
"You're scaring me, Gwen. Are you sure we shouldn't call it quits on this conversation right now while we're ahead?"
"Only if you don't want the world to stick around long enough for Jenny to graduate from high school and go to an Ivy League college and have babies of her own one day."
"You're serious?"
"Unfortunately, yes."
The deputy director, never once breaking eye contact, was silent then. It was her job to know when people were telling the truth. "Okay, tell me," Gwendy told her. When she was finished, almost 40 minutes later, Gwendy picked up the canvas bag from the grass by her feet, pulled out the button box, and placed it on her lap. It was the first time she'd laid eyes on it in almost 25 years. She could hear Richard Ferris's voice whisper inside her head,
"Don't touch the button box or even take it out of the canvas bag unless absolutely necessary."
Was a thing absolutely necessary when it was absolutely the only way? Of course it was.
"Do you remember the part of my story about Jonestown?"
She nodded. "You believe you caused it? Or rather, that strange box did. May I?"
She reached for it. Gwendy pulled it away, clutching it to her chest. Because it would be dangerous for Charlotte to touch it, yes, but that wasn't the only reason.
There was jealousy as well.
She thought of Gollum and the Lord of the Rings.
"It's mine, precious, my birthday present."
Gwendy didn't want to feel that way about the box, but she did.
It was terrible, but there was no denying it.
"I guess I may not," Charlotte said.
She was giving Gwendy a measuring look, and Gwendy knew, old friend or not, she was only a few steps from deciding Senator Peterson was barking mad.
"It would be dangerous for you to even touch it," Gwendy said. "I know how that sounds and what you're thinking, because I'd be thinking it too. Just give me a little more rope, okay?"
"Okay." "I thought the part of Guiana I was concentrating on when I conducted my experiment back then was deserted. I didn't know about Jonestown. Hardly anyone did before it hit the news worldwide. It's not like there was any internet to check back then. And remember, I was just a kid. This time I did my research, and I'm still not sure no one will be hurt or killed."
Gwendy swallowed. Her throat was bone dry. "The red button is the least dangerous by far, but it's still a loaded gun. As I found out when all those people drank the Kool-Aid back in 1978.
"Gwendy, you don't really believe that you..."
"Hush. No interruptions, you promised."
Charlotte sat back, but Gwendy could still see the worry in Charles' eyes and the disbelief. There might be a way to fix that.
"I think you should have a piece of chocolate. That might help to open your mind a little."
Curling her pinky, Gwendy pulled one of the levers on the side of the box. Out came a tiny chocolate animal.
"Oh my God,"
Charlotte cried, picking it up.
"Is it an aardvark?"
"Not sure, but I believe it's an anteater.
No two are ever the same, which is quite a trick in itself. Go ahead, try it. I think you'll like it."
"I'm allergic to chocolate, Gwen. It makes me break out in hives."
"You won't be allergic to this, I promise."
Charlotte lifted it to her nose for a sniff, and that sealed the deal. She popped it into her mouth. Her eyes widened.
"Oh my God, it's so good."
"Yes. And how do I look to you?"
"How?"
Charlotte really looked.
"Clear. It's like I can see every strand of hair on your head, every pore on your cheeks. You've never been so clear. And lovely. You always were, but now... Wow!
Charlotte gave a small, giggly laugh. Not the sort of sound you expected to hear from a CIA topsider, but Gwendy wasn't surprised. She took Charlotte's hands in both of hers.
What am I thinking?
Want to hazard a guess?
How could I?
Charlotte began, then. A pyramid. The Great Pyramid. The one in Giza. Gwendy let go of her friend's hands, satisfied.
How could I know that?
Charlotte whispered. It was the chocolate. But not just the chocolate. You've trained your mind to read other people. You could say that telepathy is part of your job. The chocolates just give you a head start. My mother ate some, and they made her feel good, but she never had any mind-reading ability. They just cured her cancer, Gwendy thought. It will fade, but you'll feel good for the rest of the day. Maybe tomorrow as well.
Look at the water, Charlotte whispered. The sun fills it with stars. I never saw that before.
Gwendy reached out and turned Charlotte's face back to hers. Never mind that now. Do you know what's going on in Egypt as of this week? Probably for the rest of the spring? Charlotte did. Of course she did. It would have been part of her daily briefings. A bad outbreak of coronavirus. It's killing a lot of people, and the government ordered a lockdown that will last at least until the middle of May. And they are not fucking around. Show up on the street and you're apt to get arrested. Yes, Gwendy said. And that big old pyramid, the oldest of the world's seven wonders, is deserted. No tourists snapping pictures, no workmen. It's as close to perfect for demonstration purposes as I can get. Gwendy squeezed her eyes closed and thought about the Great Pyramid of Giza, aka the Great Pyramid of Khufu, aka the Pyramid of Cheops. She hated the idea of vandalizing it, but it would be a small price to pay for convincing Charlotte. She told her old friend what was going to happen and then pressed the red button, really putting her arm into it. 5 minutes later, she was back in her car, speeding north on I-95, trying to make it in time to a lunch meeting in downtown D.C. Before leaving, Charlotte asked for another chocolate. Gwendy refused, but invited Charles to pull the lever on the other side of the box. Gwendy wasn't sure a Morgan silver dollar would slide out. They didn't always. But this time one did. Charlotte gasped with delight. Take it, Gwendy said. A little thank you for listening to me and not calling for the men in the white coats. Later that night, when her cell phone rang, Gwendy was sitting in bed watching CNN. It was showing drone footage of a monstrous pile of rubble where the Great Pyramid had once stood. No earthquake, the Chiron read. Scientists mystified. After a brief search, she found her phone tangled up in a blanket. She picked up after the third ring, knowing who it was this time on the other end, despite the unknown caller tag in the phone's ID window. Charlotte Morgan didn't bother with a hello or any other pleasantries. All she said was, "Holy jumping Jesus." "Yes," Gwendy said. "That about covers it."
"I'll get you on a space trip, Gwen, if it's what you want. That's a promise. It may take a while, so hang tough. We'll talk.
But not about this." "No, not about this." "Okay, make it as soon as possible. Using it today gave me a very creepy feeling. And some very creepy ideas." Some of them had been violent and strangely sexual.
"I understand." Charlotte paused. "The Great Pyramid. Holy fuck." Then she was gone, saying goodbye no more than she'd said hello. Gwendy tossed her phone aside and returned her gaze to the screen. Now the Chiron read, 6 killed in collapse. They had been young adventurers from Sweden who had broken out of lockdown to explore the pyramid on their own and had been crushed under tons of limestone blocks. To Gwendy, it was relearning an old lesson. No matter how careful you were, no matter how good your intentions, the button box always extracted its due in blood.
Chapter 22.
The video conference is a big hit, a real smasheroo. No slip-ups, no brain freezes, and Gwendy actually manages to have fun. In fact, the entire flight crew has a good time, culminating in a rowdy, impromptu toast. Vacuum-sealed pouches of orange juice, apple juice, and lemonade raised high in the air, saluting Senator Peterson for a job well done. Even Gareth Winston, who is grasping a fruit juice pouch in each of his meaty palms, looks almost happy for her. Or maybe, Gwendy thinks with a certain mean enjoyment, he finally managed to move his bowels. "Okay, everyone," Kathy Lundgren calls out. "Time to get back to work. We have less than 12 hours until we join our Chinese friends at MF1. "May we never see them," David Graves grumbles, and Kathy swats him playfully on the shoulder as he floats by. Gwendy watches as the others begin to stroke their way back to their flight chairs. "Thank you all again. That was an unexpected and much appreciated surprise." Gwendy still feels pretty terrific, but the buzz is starting to fade. If her memory is correct, and that's obviously a big if nowadays, the chocolate high used to last much longer, days instead of hours. But then again, it's been more than 25 years since she last ate one, so how much does she really remember? Added to that, she's 64 now. Not quite a geezer, but getting there. Or do only men get to be geezers? Maybe she's almost a geezerette. Either way, she's not complaining. She's thrilled, in fact. Not to mention relieved. The first video conference is behind her. It will only get easier from here on out, now that she knows what to do. And perhaps best of all, Gwendy remembered their names, every last one of the other 9 crew members. Plus, she remembered their job titles and onboard duties and any other number of details she'd long ago misplaced. She grabs the iPad from beneath her seat and swipes her way into her secure email account. Scanning the dozens of notices in her mailbox, she stops on an email from Progressive Insurance. It's time-coded from earlier in the day. She opens it. The email is 2 pages long and is signed, electronically of course, by a Progressive representative by the name of Frederick Lynn. She skims its contents. The insurance company is currently working on an estimate of the damage to her house. It has been secured with heavy plastic sheeting and wooden framework where necessary. The power has been turned off, and the remaining items in the refrigerator and freezer removed. The Castle Rock Sheriff's Department, as well as the Maine State Police, will be keeping an eye on it in case of thieves or ordinary garden variety souvenir hunters. Also, her neighbors, Ed and Lorraine Henderson, promise to keep a close watch. The insurance company doesn't expect to hear back from Ms. Peterson until her return from outer space. Mr. Freddie Lynn actually uses those exact words, which brings another smile to Gwendy's face. But they need to ask one important question. Does Mrs. Peterson have any pets that may have gotten loose during the fire? They found no food or water dishes, but it's standard procedure to ask. After that, there's a lot of technical policy information she has little interest in reading. Gwendy thanks God that Bridget has Pippa the sausage dog and hits the reply button. She types, "No pets. Thanks for all you're doing," and hits send. "I've just sent my first email from outer space," she thinks incredulously. She refreshes the mailbox screen and scrolls until she finds an email from Norris Ridgwick. It's shorter than the insurance letter, but just barely. April 17th, 2026. "Dear Gwendy, I'm very sorry about the fire. I've spoken with Brian Gardner at the CR Sheriff's Department, and he's going to make sure no one gets within shouting distance of your house. I also rode out and talked to your father so he wouldn't have to hear about the fire on the news. He was pretty down, but I told him the insurance folks would fix it up as good as new. Although they never do, which we both know. He asked me to give you all his love. Now to the real reason I'm writing. I hope you won't be mad, but the last few years I've been doing a little digging of my own about Ryan and his mysterious trip to Derry. A man can only fish so much, you know. You never asked me to get involved, but I figured it was worth a shot.
Worst I could do was burn up some gas money and waste a little time. I guess I would have made a pretty crummy detective because for the longest time I wasn't able to find out much of anything, and I sure didn't get any help from the local constabulary. They basically told me to buzz off. I decided to take one more shot at it last week. No luck. Until, that is, I was getting ready to come on back to the Rock. I stopped to gas up at one of those no-name extra barrel stations, the kind where a fellow actually pumps your gas and washes your windshield. This guy was named Gerald Jerry Keel, an old-timer who was sort of refreshing because he didn't have any of that, excuse the language, fuck you and the horse you rode in on, dairy attitude. I asked my questions, showed him Ryan's picture, and right away he said yeah. He especially remembered the Gwendy for Senate stickers because there were three of them plastered across his back bumper. That makes Gwendy wipe away a tear. He said Ryan asked directions to Bassey Park because he had to meet a man there by the big Paul Bunyan statue. Keel laughed and said, I can give you directions, but you won't find Big Paul because he's long gone. Ryan jotted down the turns and drove off. I thought that was all I was going to get, but then Keel said something else. I was recording on my phone, so I can give it to you exactly. He said, there's an abandoned warehouse past the gas station, on the corner of Niebolt and Pond. Soon as your boy paid and left, an old Chrysler pulled out from behind that warehouse. Big as a boat it was, and an ugly green color that almost hurt your eyes to look at. I could be wrong, but I almost thought it was following the man you're asking about. Now I bet I know what you're thinking, Senator Gwendy, because I'm thinking the same. It's a great, big, damn, bust-out-crying shame that there was no surveillance footage of that accident. If it was an accident. I would just about love to know if the car that mowed down your husband and left him dead in the street was an old green Chrysler, big as a boat.
Only that doesn't seem right. Didn't someone call her and say her husband had been hit by some other kind of car? And of a different color? Gwendy thinks so, but she can no longer trust her memory. She isn't even sure there was a call. At least she can still read, so she finishes Norris's email.
That's all I have, and I think it's all I'm going to get. That's a strange town, and I could live just as long and die just as happy if I never set foot inside the dairy city limits again. I'll keep digging if you want me to, but I honestly don't think there's more to find out. I hope you're not upset I started in the first place. I meant well. In the meantime, safe travels up there. I respect your courage, but all I can say otherwise is better you than me. Your friend, Norris.
Gwendy can hear Norris's voice, surprisingly deep for a man of his slender build, as she reads the email for a second time. When she's finished, she just sits there staring at the iPad screen, her eyes gradually losing focus. The good feelings she's been reveling in for the past couple of hours have vanished and been replaced by, she doesn't exactly know what. Shock? Confusion? Fear? Yes, all of those things. Confusion she's used to since her mind started to go. The others less so.
Save my seat, she says to no one in particular. I'm off to use the ladies.
She unbuckles her safety harness and swims her way down to the common area on level 4. What in the world were you up to, Ryan? The shiny white lavatory door is closed, and once again Gwendy is reminded of the sterile morgue lockers she's seen so often on television. The panel above the latch reads, Available. Unsure if she really needs to pee or if she's simply going through the motions, Gwendy reaches for the door. Before she can open it, someone grasps her shoulder from behind. She lets out a squeak and spins around, arms flailing. Gareth Winston is floating a foot or so off the ground, a startled look on his face. Jumping Jesus, Winston, don't ever sneak up on me like that again.
Sorry, he says, drifting backward. He doesn't look particularly sorry. I didn't mean to scare you. I usually make a lot of noise when I come into a room. I'm kind of clumsy that way. He shrugs his ample shoulders. But I'm as light as a feather up here. It takes some getting used to.
It certainly does, Gwendy says.
Anyway, I just wanted to apologize for giving you a hard time before. It's none of my business what's in that case of yours, and I shouldn't have said what I said.
Gwendy can't believe her ears. Not that long ago, she'd questioned whether the phrase thank you existed in Gareth Winston's vocabulary. She would have bet her last dollar that the words I apologize did not. She's pleasantly surprised to find that she's mistaken. Apology accepted.
When you have as much money as I do, you sometimes fall into bad habits, like always thinking you should get your way. I'm working on it.
I know quite a few people in Washington, D.C. who could use some help with that, and they don't have a fraction of your bank account.
Winston laughs. Well, thanks for accepting my apology. I'll let you get on with your...
He gestures at the lavatory door.
You know.
Gwendy offers him a genuine smile. She could get used to this new and improved Gareth Winston, and extends her hand. Thank you for being so gracious. Winston reaches out and takes it. Suddenly, Winston appears very clear to her, very bright and in focus, almost as if he's somehow lit from within, and everything else around him falls away. Thinking about it later, she'll be reminded of a moment from the second time she had the button box in her possession, when she stepped inside the mind of a madman the Castle Rock newspaper called the Tooth Fairy. And, of course, when her old friend Charlotte Morgan knew she was thinking of the Great Pyramid. Although Gareth Winston is still smiling, he's not smiling inside. He's never smiling inside. But he is in love. The man he's in love with is sitting behind the wheel of a car. Gareth is in the passenger seat looking at him. It may be impolite to stare, but Gareth can't tear his eyes away from that face. Gareth thinks it's the face of a blonde angel. He thinks he would give away everything he owns if the blonde angel allowed him just one kiss. Only in this flash, it lasts maybe 2 seconds, 4 at most, Gwendy sees the driver as he really is. His real face is old, haggard, and rotting from the inside out. His eyes are milky with cataracts. His lower lip has lost all its tension and sags away from blackening teeth. She has a terrible premonition that Richard Ferris will look this way before too long. The car is big and old. The acre of hood is a weirdly vibrant green that hurts her eyes to look at. The word on the oversized steering wheel, Winston jerks back, breaking their grip. His eyes are wide in their pockets of fat.
Jesus, woman!
No humble I'm sorry in that voice now. He sounds pissed off. And scared.
What was that?
I don't know, Gwendy says. The vision is already fading. If she can't get to her little notebook soon, it will be entirely gone, like a dream 10 minutes after waking. Static electricity, I guess. Dr. Dale Glenn goes floating by, peering at something on his iPad. Very likely. It's common up here. He says it without looking up from whatever he's reading.
Whew, it was strong, whatever it was,
Winston says, and manages a fake comic book laugh.
Ha ha! You'll have to excuse me, Senator. I have some emails I need to answer.
Off he goes, leaving Gwendy by the lavatory door. She has to try twice to unlatch it. Adesh floats by and asks if she's okay. She doesn't say anything, isn't sure she can, but nods, her hair floating above her head like seaweed. She finally opens the door and pulls herself inside. She fumbles for the button that will light the in-use panel on the outside. There are no locks in the common area, a safety precaution in case someone has a medical emergency, and tries to raise the lid on the toilet. It won't come. A red panel lights up, saying, "Pressurize." Right, almost forgot. Now she forgets so much. She thumbs the button to the right of the toilet and the red light goes out. There's a low humming as the toilet does whatever it's supposed to do so she can lift the lid without yanking all of the air in the tiny capsule first into the bowl and then into space. It occurs to her that if Kathy is up front in the control area, she will have seen the warning light blink on and then off. And if she's not there, Sam Drinkwater or Dave Graves probably is. She hopes they'll just shrug it off. Probably they will, but it's not good. Forgetting such elementary things from their training sessions is definitely NG. Gwendy lowers her coverall, sits, and turns the proper dial to its lowest setting. She feels a gentle sucking sensation that means her pee will go down instead of just floating around under her butt in globules. She lowers her face into her hands as she urinates. Something just happened when she took Gareth Winston's hand. Something important. Something about a car. Or two cars of different colors? Possibly something about Ryan as well, but probably not. Probably she's mixing up Norris's communique with what just happened when she took Gareth Winston's hand. Whatever it was, it's gone. God damn what's happening to me, Gwendy thinks. God damn it to hell. She might be able to get it back if she ate one of the chocolates, and it's a tempting idea, but she must not. Even one was dangerous, and it probably doesn't matter. Does it? Chapter 23. The crew and passengers of Eagle Heavy have seen the MF space station on each of their last six orbits. Because each of these orbits varies slightly, making a fan shape on the computer screens, many flags sometimes looks above and sometimes below, but it's always on the starboard side, and it's always amazing.
Looks like the space station in 2001, Reggie Black comments as they pass on their last non-docking orbit.
MF is less than 25 miles away on this one.
Only MF has one ring instead of two.
And more spokes, Jafari says. The two of them are shoulder to shoulder in front of the porthole, with Gwendy floating above and between them. I believe that in the movie there were only four spokes.
From the control area, Sam Drinkwater says, MF is very similar to Kubrick's version. You have to remember, it's not always art imitating life. Sometimes it's the other way around.
No idea what that means, Gareth says.
He's also looking at the MF station, but since the porthole on the right is taken, he's stuck with his iPad and sounds irritated about it.
It means that the people who designed the station saw the movie, Sam says. Maybe as children. To them, this is how space stations are supposed to look.
Ridiculous, Gareth snaps. It was built as it was simply because form always follows function, not because some space architect saw a movie when he was five.
Sam doesn't argue the point. Maybe because Gareth is the paying passenger. In certain confidential pre-flight files, Gwendy has seen Gareth and herself referred to as the geese, an old airline term for passengers. Or maybe Sam's just bored with the subject. Either way, Gwendy thinks he's right. When looking at her Apple Watch, she often thinks that some gearhead designer was enchanted by Dick Tracy's wrist radio when he or she was a kid. In any case, the MF station is huge. The actual specs have left her mind, but she does remember that the endlessly curving outer corridor circling its rim is 2.5 miles in length. Even with the Great Pyramid gone, she thinks, there are still seven wonders in the world. Except the new seventh is actually above the world. And for the next 19 days, it's going to be their home. Assuming the next couple of hours go well, that is. Docking is the most delicate and dangerous part of the entire mission, even more dangerous than their eventual landing on a floating pad off Malta. Kathy Lundgren comes on general comm and tells them to don their pressure suits. For a moment, Gwendy is bewildered. She knows what the suit is, of course she does. The question is, where did she put it? She sees Adesh and Jafari pulling their storage cases from beneath their seats and almost slaps her forehead. Duh, get it together, Gwendy. Is her memory worse since the last chocolate wore off? She thinks it probably is. The box always exacts a price. She gets her suit out and slips into it. For a moment, she's distracted by the port side portal. Did a bird just fly by out there? On the way to the feeder by the picnic table in their... Zip up, Senator Gwendy? Dale Glenn says, pointing at her open suit. Yes, I was just thinking about... Is she going to tell him she thought a bird just flew past, 260 miles above the Earth? Or that for just a moment she lost her place in time? It doesn't matter. She zips her suit and gets her helmet on and locked, putting her increasingly unreliable mind on hold and letting muscle memory take over. Click, click, snap, and done. Easy as pie, she tells herself, and connects to her iPad and the screens ahead of her seat. At first, there's nothing to see in the forward view, and then that huge and improbable wheel comes over the rim of the Earth. It's a majestic, almost heart-stopping sight, revolving slowly and revealing the flags of the 61 nations that took part and have the right, theoretically at least, to use it. All it needs, she thinks, is the soundtrack music from 2001. Thus spake somebody. Can't remember, just that it starts with a Z. In the center is a white bubble containing the telescopic equipment Jafari Bankel probably can't wait to get his hands on. Above the bubble is something that looks like a stainless steel masthead topped with a gray cup lined with glittering gold mesh. It is sending messages to the stars and hoping for a response. Kathy Lundgren. Mission Control, are we go for docking? Eileen Braddock. Go for dock, Eagle Heavy. We are green across the board. David Graves. Visors down, campers. We've got 17 minutes, Kathy finishes. Crew, roger your visors. They do. Give it to Becky, Eileen says. Giving it to Becky, roger, Kathy replies. No commands, all computer. What do you say, Becky?
That I have the bus,
the voice of Becky, the computer, replies.
Dave says, and what kind of bus is it, Becky?
It is a magic bus, Becky says, and actually plays a few bars of the Who song.
This hardly seems the time for stupid computer tricks, Gareth says.
He sounds wound up and pissed off, that amiable tone of voice from earlier outside of the lavatory a distant memory.
Next, you'll be asking it to tell knock-knock jokes while our lives are at risk.
No one's life is at risk, Kathy says. This is a walk in the park. If only, Gwendy thinks. Now there's a touch of gravity again as Becky fires the aiming rockets in small, feathery bursts.
Ops, do you want to go around another couple of times? Eileen asks.
Sunset in 20 minutes, your location.
Negative ground, all good with us, and Becky can see in the dark.
But Kathy and Sam can't, Gwendy thinks. And computer-directed docking only works if Becky's programming is flawless and if there's no dreaded holy shit moment.
Roger, Eagle Heavy.
This time it's a male voice, Eileen's superior, not a rocket jockey, but some political appointee. Gwendy should be able to remember his name. She was the one who appointed him, for Christ's sake, but she can't. She tries some of Dr. Ambrose's tricks, but none of them work. A sudden brilliant thought strokes across her mind, as scary as a stroke of lightning hitting just feet away. Where is the button box? Is it in her tiny capsule of a cabin, or the storage compartment beneath her seat? Oh God, is it sitting home on the high shelf in the garage? What if she forgot to bring it? She has enough wit to change her comm to private and then select the Bugman's setting on her iPad.
Adesh, do you know what I did with the steel case I brought on board? The one with...
Yes, the one with classified stamped on it.
He points down. She looks and sees it's beneath her leg, just as it was on liftoff.
Thank you, she says. Forgive the flightiness. I'm a little nervous about the docking.
Totally understood. He smiles at her through his visor, but there's no smile in his eyes. What she sees there is consideration. Maybe evaluation. She doesn't like it. They must not know what's wrong with me until the mission is accomplished. After that, it won't matter what they know. There's a thud from above them as Eagle Heavy's docking hatch slides open on its servo motors.
Ida is in place and green across the board, Becky says.
Gwendy has no trouble with that. Ida is the International Docking Adapter, so called because every nation that can send rockets to MF uses the same system. She can remember that, but for the time being, her own middle name escapes her.
Locking hinges in place, Becky says.
The cabin rocks port, rocks starboard, comes steady. Little jerks accompany each movement, as if an inexperienced driver is goosing the gas pedal, releasing it, then goosing it again. A metaphor Gwendy could have done without.
10 meters, Becky says,
All at once, a huge shadow darkens the cabin, causing the interior lights to come on. Gwendy cranes her neck and sees they are passing under one of the MF station's huge spokes, clearing it by what looks like only feet. She can make out every seal and rivet.
"Jesus, too close!" Gareth cries. "Too fucking close!"
Then his voice is gone. Someone, probably Dave Graves, has cut him out of the general comm. Which is a good thing, Gwendy thinks. No one needs to listen to him bellow. Nevertheless, she braces herself for a collision that seems almost inevitable. A gloved hand takes hers. It's Jaff. She turns to him and winks. He looks scared to death, but he manages to wink back. 5 meters, Becky says. Seconds later, there's a bump. Not hard, but plenty solid. Gwendy has a moment of vertigo and realizes her body hasn't been fully aware of Eagle Heavy's constant motion until it stopped. Soft capture complete, Becky says. Kathy relays that to the ground, and Gwendy hears applause. Beside his porthole, Gareth looks bewildered. He can't hear what's happening. Gwendy selects Ops 1 on her iPad and says, "Kathy, loop Gareth in. I think he'll be okay now, and he should hear everyone in the down below is happy." Roger that. Becky tells them to stand by for final docking. There are more thuds, harder this time, as the 12 latches engage, 2x2. "Docking sequence is complete," Becky says.
"Good job, Baxter," Dave says.
"Always glad to help," Becky says. "Shall I handle the hatch opening?" "I'll do that," Kathy says. "Stand down, Becky." "Standing down," Sam Drinkwater says. "The hard line is connected. Your go for a hatch opening, Kath." Kathy turns in her seat. "Everyone pressurized? Let me hear your Roger." They give it. Gwendy thinks the rich guy, name momentarily escapes her, looks grumpy but relieved. Kathy says, "Mission control, all valves are closed and I'm opening the hatch."
"Roger, Eagle Heavy. You guys have a great time and don't do anything I wouldn't do."
"That gives us a lot of latitude," Kathy says. "We'll talk to you once we're on board Many Flags. Thanks to everyone in the down below. This is Eagle, over and out." Chapter 24. One by one, they float through the hatch, then up the hard line with its blue foam sides, and finally into Many Flags. Kathy Lundgren is first, Gareth Winston last. Gwendy's between Reggie Black, the physicist, and Adesh, a.k.a. Bugman. Gwendy feels a slight tug of gravity as she enters. Her mind is currently as clear as a bell, and she remembers that the station's slow spin has returned a fraction of her weight. She and the other newbies look around, bouncing slowly up and down. Touch and go, touch and go. Her first thought is that USA Control would look almost like a hotel lobby if the walls weren't lined with equipment, monitors, and a nightmare spaghetti of cords and wires. And if the walls weren't padded, of course. Her second thought is that it's big. After 2 days in Eagle Heavy, the room looks enormous. The ceiling is at least 4 feet over her head, and one of the walls isn't a wall at all, but a long, gracefully curving window that gives a view of pure black punched through with stars.
"Okay to ditch the outerwear, guys," Sam says. "Stow 'em there."
He points to lockers along one wall. There are at least 2 dozen. 10 have lighted panels with the names of the Eagle Heavy crew. Gwendy bounce floats to hers and opens it. There's a hook for her suit and a magnetized shelf for her helmet. She's carrying the steel box with classified material stamped on it, and it would stick to the shelf, but she doesn't want to leave it there. Not with Gareth's locker right next to hers. She sees him watching her, and she doubts it's with admiration for her butt in the red eagle coverall she's wearing. "Crew to me for a minute," Kathy says. "Gather round." Gwendy closes her locker and joins the others, holding the steel box by its handle. It makes her think of the lunchbox she carried to Castle Rock Elementary long, long ago.
"Air smells better, don't you think?"
Burn Stapleton asks her.
"God, yes. Sweeter and fresher."
Also, there's instrumental music drifting down from the overhead speakers. Maybe Seals and Crofts, maybe Simon and Garfunkel. Like in a mall or a supermarket, Gwendy thinks. She's aware of something else, too. Below the humming of the monitors and equipment, there's a faint creaking sound, almost like an old wooden ship in a moderate wind. That's a little creepy, she thinks. Then, check that, it's a lot creepy, like a haunted house in a movie, or a haunted hotel. Maybe that feeling is stupid, but maybe it's valid. The MF station is huge, and except for them and half a dozen Chinese doing God knows what, it's deserted. They circle Kathy, rising and falling, touching and going. You know most of this from pre-flight orientation, but protocol demands I give you a quick refresher upon entry to the station. First, accommodations. She points at the doors marked Spoke 1, Spoke 2, and Spoke 3. Spoke 1 is flight crew, me, Sam, Dave. Spoke 2 is science crew, Reggie, Jafari, Burn, and Adesh. Spoke 3 belongs to our passengers, Gwendy and Gareth, plus Dr. Glenn. I think you newbies are going to be delighted by what you find. Someday not far in the future, Tet Corp hopes those rooms and many others like them will be occupied by paying guests. Gwendy and Gareth, you have actual suites. Only a bedroom, sitting room, and a small bathroom, but quite luxy. Don't tell the taxpayers, Gwendy stage whispers. Most of them laugh. Gareth Winston does not. Perhaps because the current administration has landed him in the 45% tax bracket. Or maybe he's just impatient with the repetition. You'll have to bring your own gear up from the Eagle. All the bellmen up here are on strike. There's more laughter, and once again, Gareth doesn't join in. Gwendy wonders when he last had to carry his own luggage. Maybe when he moved into a college dorm. Maybe never. I'll cut the rest of the lecture short, if you promise not to tell Mission Control, but I urge you to review the orientation video on your tablet again. It will guide you around the parts of the station available to us, which in this extraordinary circumstance is almost all of it. Jaff, you'll want to visit the observatory and power up what needs to be powered up so you can start sending photos back to Earth. I believe your main interest will be Mars.
Correctamundo, Jafari says.
Gwendy, you'll want to check out the weather deck. It's small, but it has tons of equipment and its own telescope. Burn, your lab is next to Adesh's bug suite in Spoke 5. Gareth interrupts.
What happened to cutting this short? I'd like to get settled in.
Kathy registers momentary irritation at this rudeness, but a moment later it's gone. Gareth is important to Tet Corp's plans for tourist travel above the Earth and therefore must be cosseted. Up to a point, Gwendy thinks. If he has to be busted on his behavior, I think I can be the bad guy. She certainly busted the man she replaced in the Senate on his behavior and on statewide TV. She just can't remember his name at present. She's never known such feelings of helplessness. I suggest we all settle in, Kathy says. After one more thing. Gareth gives a long-suffering sigh. But really, what does he have to do? It's not like he has a job up here, and Gwendy certainly doesn't intend to ask for his help on the weather deck. You all have the run of the place, except for Spoke 9. That one is currently Chinese territory. She points to an info panel below the big window, where there are 8 green lights and 1 red one. Should they unlock, which they do sometimes, to use the exercise room and the international room where they play video games and use the canteen machines, you will still stay clear. They are not particularly hospitable. But all spokes lead to the outer rim, and that's common territory. I always enjoy a run there. In this gravity, which we call Lono, I can do a mile in just over 2 minutes.
Please, Gareth says.
And Gwendy knows what he sounds like. A rich type A passenger at the end of a long flight, dismissing the flight crew the minute the plane touches down. Sometimes Gareth can be friendly, even charming. But she thinks that's just thin paint over a man who expects to be obeyed and kowtowed to.
How about it, Kathy? big Zoom meeting to get to? Byrne asks mildly. None of your affair, plant man, Gareth says.
Go, Kathy says, making an amiable shooing gesture. Get settled. My advice, take today to explore the station before starting whatever job you came here to do. Most of them head back down into the Eagle, Gareth Winston in the lead. Gwendy lingers, then makes her slow way to Kathy, who is talking with Dr. Glenn. Got time for a question? Gwendy asks.
Of course, how can I help?
Dale Glenn bounces his way over to the window and stands looking out into the infinite blackness, hands clasped behind his back. The others have gone.
My room, Gwendy says. She can't bring herself to call it a suite.
Does the door lock?
None of them do, but your accommodation comes with a security safe, very much like the kind they have in hotel rooms.
It is sort of a hotel room, actually. She looks meaningfully at the steel box Gwendy's carrying.
You punch in a 4-digit combo. Your special cargo should fit quite nicely, Senator.
She's speaking officially because this is official business, Gwendy thinks.
Thank you. That's something of a relief.
She glances toward Dr. Glenn. He's at a safe distance, but she still lowers her voice.
Mr. Winston, Gareth, has shown, an interest. Perhaps he was interested in this as well.
She reaches into the elasticized waist pocket of her jumper. What she brings out, to Gwendy's horror, is her red notebook, the one where she keeps all the things she doesn't want to forget, including the code that opens the classified box.
He said your cabin door was ajar and he found it floating in the corridor.
That must have been the case, because he wouldn't have any reason to be snooping in your cabin, would he?
Of course not, Gwendy says, taking the notebook and stowing it in her own pocket. She feels cold all over.
Thank you. Kathy takes Gwendy by the shoulder. Do you think he was snooping? Because I'd have to take that rather seriously, Mr. Moneybags or not.
The hell of it is, Gwendy doesn't know. She doesn't think she left the notebook unsecured. She doesn't think she left the door of her cabin unlatched so it could float out in the constant circulation of the air purifiers. But she can't be sure.
No, she says. Probably not. Kathy, you have the pocket rocket, correct?
It's on board?
Yes, although what it's for is apparently above my pay grade.
And I'm go for a spacewalk on day 7?
Kathy doesn't reply at first. She looks uncomfortable. That's the plan, but plans sometimes change. Several people have been talking to me, including
me, Dr. Glenn says.
He has rejoined them without Gwendy noticing, and now he asks the very question she's been dreading.
Senator, is there anything you want to tell us?
Chapter 25. Gwendy gave up trying to believe there was nothing wrong with her on a spring day in 2024, about 4 months after her meeting with Charlotte Morgan. It was a piddling 700-word essay that did it. The kind of thing she should have been able to bang out in an hour. Nothing but fluff and puff. But it brought down her wall of denial as surely as the magic box's red button had brought down the Great Pyramid of Giza. The Washington Post ran an occasional feature called My Five, in which various famous people wrote about 5 great, or simply overlooked, things in their home states. John Cusack wrote about stuff in his native Illinois. The mystery writer Laura Lippman wrote about Miss Shirley's Cafe in Baltimore and the swimming hole at Kilgore Falls. Gwendy, of course, was asked to write a My Five about Maine. She was actually looking forward to the assignment when she sat down in the small office of her Washington, D.C. townhouse. Going back to her home state was always a pleasure, even if the trip was only mental. She wrote about Thunder Hole in Bar Harbor, the Maine Discovery Museum in Bangor, the lighthouse on Pemaquid Point, and the Farnsworth Art Museum. She paused then, thinking she wanted to finish with something that was just plain fun. She sat tapping her nose with the eraser of a pencil from her jar, a habit that went back to childhood, until it came to her. Simone's, of course, She tossed the pencil back in its jar and typed, "My fifth choice is in Lewiston, about 20 miles up the road from my hometown of Castle Rock. Turn right off Lisbon Street onto Chestnut, find a parking space, good luck, and step into Simone's. It's just a little storefront restaurant, but the smell is heaven. The specialty of the house is crankshafts." Here she stopped, staring at the screen. Crankshafts? In a restaurant? What was she thinking? I wasn't thinking. I was on autopilot and had a senior moment, that's all. Only it wasn't a senior moment, it was a brain freeze, and she'd been having a lot of them lately. Walking around looking for her car keys while she had them in her hand, deciding to throw a frozen dinner in the microwave for lunch and finding herself looking for the fridge in the living room, more than once getting up from a nap when she didn't remember lying down. And after missing a couple of committee meetings and one roll call vote, not important, thank God, she was depending more and more on her assistant, Anne Marie Briggs, to keep her apprised of her schedule, a thing she had always taken care of herself. "Forget a roll call," the old Gwendy would have said. "Never in this life." And now this, staring back at her from the screen of her Mac. "The specialty of the house is crankshafts." She deleted the sentence and wrote, "You'll never have a better burgomeister." Gwendy looked at this and put a hand to her forehead. She felt hot to herself. Hot and strange. A month ago, back home in Castle Rock for the weekend, she had gotten into the car with some specific destination in mind and had found herself at the Rumford Rockin' Bowl instead, with no idea of what she had set out to do. She'd told herself, "What the hell, a beautiful day for a drive," and laughed it off. She wasn't laughing now. What was the specialty of the house at Simone's? A frightening spiral of words cascaded through her mind. Catgut, doll face, candle wax, mortarboard. Mortarboard, that's it. She typed it, but it didn't look quite right. Anne Marie poked her head in. "Going to Starbucks, Senator? Want anything?" "No, but I'm stuck here. What are those things you eat?" Anne Marie frowned. "Have to be a bit more specific, boss." "They come in bread thingies," Gwendy gestured with her hands. "Red and tasty. You eat them with much up at picnics and such. I can't think of the word." The corners of Anne Marie's mouth turned up, forming dimples. The expression of someone waiting for the punchline of a joke. Hot dogs? "Hot dogs!" Gwendy exclaimed, and actually pumped a fist in the air. "Right, right, of course it is, of course." Anne Marie's incipient smile was gone. "Boss? Gwendy, are you feeling okay?" "Yes," Gwendy said, but she wasn't. "I meant of course, not of course. Bring me a regular black, will you?" "Sure," Anne Marie said, and left, but not before giving Gwendy a final puzzled glance over her shoulder. Alone again, Gwendy stared at the screen. The word Anne Marie had given her was gone, sliding through her fingers like a small, slippery fish. She no longer wanted to write the goddamn essay, and she hadn't meant to say of course, but of course. "Of course, of course, of course, of course," she murmured. She began to cry. "Dear God, what's wrong with me?" Only she knew. Of course she did. She even knew when it had started. After pushing the red button to give Charlotte Morgan a demonstration of how dangerous the button box was, and how important it was for the two of them to keep it a dead secret between them until it could be disposed of in the ultimate dumping ground. But Charlotte couldn't know about this. No one could. Chapter 26. Day 2 on Many Flags. The crew members have started doing their various jobs, with the exception of Gareth Winston, who has no assigned job. There are many wonders to explore in Many Flags, but so far as Gwendy can tell, the billionaire has spent most of the day in his suite. Like Achilles brooding in his tent, Gwendy thinks.
She can relate because she has spent a certain amount of brooding time herself since Dr. Glenn asked his question, or rather, detonated it in her face. Unlike Gareth, Gwendy has been plenty occupied. She made a brief trip to the weather deck, checking out the various equipment there, and gaping at the earth below her, watching as darkness moved smoothly over North and South America, blue and violet buttons on the button box. She participated in a Health and Human Services committee meeting via Zoom. She talked about the importance of space exploration to a class of fifth graders in Boise who had won the video conference with her in some kind of competition, or maybe it was a lottery. She thinks all those things went okay, but the pure hell of it is she can no longer be sure. She swallowed 2 Tylenol for a stress headache, but she knows it will take more than Tylenol to get her through what comes next. They all knew, or suspected, it seemed. Everyone on board. Knew what? Suspected what? Why, that Senator Gwendolyn Peterson had slipped a cog, or maybe even 2. Was a pack of fries short of a Happy Meal, a beer short of a 6-pack, that the ever-loving cheese had started to slip off her ever-loving cracker. And because they were 260 miles above the Earth, with a U.S. senator in charge of some secret mission of A1A importance, Kathy and Dr. Glenn had confronted her. They didn't know what was in her steel box, but they did know that Gwendy was slated for a spacewalk on day 7, and when she went out, she would be in possession of a small rocket, 6 feet long and 4 feet in diameter. No more than a drone, really. Only it was powered by a tiny nuclear engine that could keep it driving onward and outward for perhaps as long as 200 years. After that, it would continue forever on pure inertia. That nuclear power plant, although no bigger than a model train engine, was powerful. If the operator, Gwendy, fucked up the initiation sequence while she was floating around out there, it could either blow a hole in the MF station or possibly destabilize it, sending it either into deep space or plunging into Earth's atmosphere, where it would burn up. Not that Gwendy would know. She'd be incinerated in the first 2 seconds. Kathy had been as delicate as she could be. I wouldn't feel comfortable sending you out there, even with a buddy, if I felt you were suffering some mental debility. Dr. Glenn was blunter, and she had to respect him for that. Senator, do you suspect you might be suffering from early-onset Alzheimer's disease? I hate to ask the question, but under the circumstances, I feel I have to. Gwendy had known it might come to this, and had worked out her story with Dr. Ambrose, who had agreed to help her with only the greatest reluctance. They both understood that the best story was one that incorporated as much of the truth as possible. In accordance with that, she told Kathy and Doc Glenn that because she had been entrusted with something of gravest importance to the entire world, she'd been under severe stress for 2 freaking years. She hadn't been sleeping well, and that was why she sometimes forgot things. Kathy readily admitted that 95% of the time Gwendy had handled herself up to or above the accepted standard.
But we're in space. Things can go wrong. We don't talk about it when we do our PR stuff, but everyone knows it. Even Gareth knows it, which is why he's prepared to perform certain tasks in an emergency situation. 95% isn't good enough. It's got to be 100.
I'm fine, Gwendy protested.
Good to go.
Then you won't mind taking a test, will you? Doc Glenn said. Just ease our minds before we send you into space with an important something we don't know about and a powerful nuclear device that we do.
All right, fine, Gwendy said.
Because really, what else could she say? Ever since Richard Ferris had shown up for the 3rd time, she had felt like a rat in an ever-narrowing corridor, one that had no exit.
It's a suicide mission, she'd told Ferris that night on the back porch, and you know it.
The test had been set for 1700 hours, and at this moment it was 1640. Time to get ready. Which meant it was time to take the button box out of the safe.
Chapter 27.
While serving in the U.S. House of Representatives, Gwendy had had good connections.
As a member of the Senate, she had even better ones, and she never needed one more than after her latest brain freeze. The specialty of the House is crankshafts, for Christ's sake. She thought of calling Charlotte Morgan, then rejected the idea out